Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Gary Steingart about his amazing new novel, Super Sad True Love Story. And we're talking today about the Rumi Concert, an evening of poetry, dance, and story and music with poet and translator of Rumi, Coleman Barks, who is joining us by phone, and story dancer Zuleika, who is here with us in the cafe, and also Grammy Award-winning cellist David Darling and percussionist Glenn Velez tomorrow, the 1st of December, at 7:30 at the Lensic. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Zuleika, you and Coleman Barks and David Darling and Glenn Velez, all of you, have been doing this concert or versions of it for some years. How did this first come together?
Well, probably we each have a different story about it, but I met Coleman, and I think our first performance was at the Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle.
Right.
On two boxes. I stood on one, and Coleman was on another, and when I would dance, I would get on my box. We didn't have any musicians, and then when I would stop dancing, I would sit down in the audience, which was right next to my box. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I thought it was a chair, but it moved. Yeah.
Yeah, I would sit down in a chair, and then I'd get up on the box.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and it went from there. Let's talk for a moment about Rumi, 13th century Sufi poet, mystic, so much more than that, incredibly prolific. And he seems to speak to every generation who reads his work. And I was wondering, Coleman, you've got a new book out of Rumi poetry. It's called The Big Red Book, The Great Masterpiece Celebrating Mystical Love and Friendship. Would you like to just start by maybe reading a few favorite poems by Rumi?
Well, okay, that seems to be, I'll just turn it random here. Whatever gives pleasure is the fragrance of the friend. Whatever makes us wonder comes from that light. Whatever is inside the ground begins to sprout because you spilled wine there. What dies in autumn comes up in spring because this way of saying no becomes in spring your praise song, yes. Well, that's enough, isn't it?
That's something to work with. Well, this book, this big red book that you put out, is there any connection between the title of the book and the Jung big red book or red book?
You know, there's not. I thought of the thing, and then I remembered that Jung has a, and it happened to be coming out this year, his wonderful secret notebook called The Red Book. And there's no connection, no. Except that they both involve red.
They have these red covers. What is the, tell us about this red, the big red book.
Uh-huh. Well, there are two main publications that Rumi had during his lifetime. That is the Masnavi, this is a very long, in six books, and then the book called the Shams, or the Divani Shamsi Tabriz, the works of Shams of Tabriz, which is all the odes and all the quatrains, and usually it was published in a big red book. So I just decided that even though this is not nearly as big as his book, this is about 1/6 of the poems that are in his book. But it's the poems I have worked on from that area of his life for the last 34 years. So I went through and relineated and revised some, and just brought out this big book.
It's, I think, for those of us who even who have been reading poetry by one poet for that long, it's almost unimaginable to think what it would be like to work with one poet, you know, as a translator in the way that you've been doing it for such a long time. Do you find that you go back to the works that you've translated in the past and then redone them as your understanding has deepened?
That happens some, yes. It's been like an apprenticeship with a master. It's brought me so much good luck and such a lot of friends. I'm very grateful to, and for some reason or other, I don't get bored with it. It just doesn't even occur to me to be tired of doing this rephrasing work that I do, reinterpreting work. It's just continually unfolding for me for some reason. I hope it is for the readers, too.
You mentioned in your introduction a connection, you talk about a connection, kind of connection between Rumi and Walt Whitman. Say more about that.
Well, I translate him into the Whitman tradition of American free verse. In Persian, the poems are densely rhymed and rhythmed and very hypnotically musical. In English, when you get to three or four rhymes in a row, it becomes comical. Usually, you're in the area of the limerick when you hit that third rhyme in English.
Right.
But yeah, in free verse, the continuous freshening of language is happening, so that you find you're on the edge of blurting something out from the unconscious, maybe, of the soul. I remember there's a line in Song of Myself that when I read it in college, I thought, gosh, that's just amazing. And the line is, there is that in me, I do not know what it is, but I know it is in me. And it's just dashes between the... And that is a magnificent line of American poetry, I think. It's just on the edge of saying something that's almost wordless. There's that in me, I do not know what it is, but I know it is in me. And certainly we can all say yes to that. And so that's why it's beloved the world over, the American tradition of free verse that Whitman writes in, and Allen Ginsberg and Galway Connell and Sharon Olds and Adrienne Rich and a whole host of other American writers. And I just like to place Rumi in there, in the lineage of Whitman. I think he belongs there. And in the introduction there, I make a connection between a poem that Whitman wrote at the very end of his life about an old Persian master. It's an amazing synchronicity.
Wow.
Yeah.
But did he know Rumi's work?
Oh, no. He would never have heard his name. I don't imagine.
Has Rumi in English translation been a relatively recent phenomenon for American poets and readers?
Since 1929, when Reynold Nicholson translated the entire Masnavi, and then in the 1950s, A.J. Arbery began translating the odes, but he hasn't been worked on really by poets until very recently.
Well, it's such an interesting piece that you bring to it. You yourself being a poet, and also you're working through other people's translations into English. What is that?
Sure,
so you're not
yeah.
working straight from the Persian. What is the process like for you?
I didn't hear his name until I was 39 years old, so I hadn't no way of learning another language well enough to translate poetry from it. For me, it's a kind of a it's a practice, really, a kind of a listening practice, where I read the poem, and then I feel what's trying to come through it, and I try to let my own experience inform that coming through, and then I try to find language that's appropriate to the ecstatic joy or the grief or the wisdom coming through. And so it's a kind of a temporary trance that I go into, I think, where I try to let the images carry whatever wisdom is coming through into new language. And so I look at a page of English in scholarly translation, and I write another page.
So it's both, I mean, the way you describe it, it sounds like a kind of a meditation practice and a creative artistic practice and an attempt to bring it in an accurate way to other people.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I try to make a new poem in English. I'm not so much trying to be faithful in the old way of scholars to the text, but I don't invent images. I try to let the imagery carry whatever is coming through.
We're talking about Rumi with Coleman Barks, who is part of the Rumi Concert, which is happening tomorrow night at the Lenzik, an evening of poetry, music, dance, and story. And story dancer Zuleika is here with us. For those who've never seen Zuleika, what do you mean by story dancing? What is story dancing?
You know, when I was listening to Coleman speaking, I realized that one of the beauties of this concert is its Americanness in a kind of free verse, if you will, in different packages. Like, we have David playing, and we have Glenn and myself, and I have a background in contemporary movement as well as very traditional dancing from India and Bali and different places. And when I found the word story dancer, it's because every classical tradition is a dance tradition that keeps the stories. But I didn't, since I'm not from India and I'm not from Afghanistan and I'm not from Bali, although I have roots in those things in my studies, I wanted to do something of a free nature but stay true to stories. And so that's how the story dancer image came to me.
Is it possible to dance a Rumi poem?
Well, I think so. I mean, the beauty of it is in the ancient traditions, people would sing or speak poetry, let's say in India, and they would say a line of poetry, and then they might say it again, and they might say it again. And that became a style of dance and poetry called tumri, which meant that you would go deep into the meaning of the phrase in the moment. It was not a thing you made up ahead of time. And that inspired me a lot. And hearing Coleman's renderings of Rumi opened the windows for us to explore in together at the same time. Because when you hear David playing, David's a very classically trained cellist who then discovered the art of improvisation in his life and made a bridge between the classical and the free. And Glenn also did the same thing, actually. He's very, very trained in many forms of hand percussion, instruments and studies and all the rhythm language that goes with it. So in a way, each of us had our own way of doing this, and then we came together and something else happens. It's, I would have to say, magic.
The magic that you talk about makes me think of, I mean, I was reading the poems in this new big red book, all these Rumi poems, and the subtitle says Mystical Love and Friendship. And friendship is such a huge part of what we learn from reading Rumi and Rumi's life. And maybe Coleman, you could talk for a moment about this great life-changing, gigantic friendship in Rumi's life and what it meant to the work.
Mm. The friendship is a way in Rumi's poetry. It means a friendship with an in the sense that we ordinarily use the word as with another person, but it's also a friendship with a consciousness, with one's own consciousness, and with the depths of the being in the deepest core of the self. So there's a resonance that has to do with a kind of vitality that's connected with every living thing, I think, and with all life. Those poems flow out of that knowing and that astonishment at the friendship. Shams of Tabriz, his friend, was a reminder of him of that resonance. And so the poems just give in to that music. And there was movement involved too with the friendship. The music and the movement and the words help us to remember a kind of a way of being alive that maybe we've forgotten for a while. And so that's why it's continually exciting to me, is that it's a rediscovery.
Reads the poems and reads about this friendship between Rumi and Shams of Tabriz, it's the kind of love that perhaps many of us associate with something that's only possible in some kind of romantic love, and widening it from that box called romantic love. It seems like these poems, you know, you can say this book or that movie or this poem was life-changing, but this is really life-changing stuff. This is stuff that changes the people who read it. I imagine it's changed you.
It's all about opening the heart, but that's a very complicated thing, isn't it? If it's got to be an experience, or it's nothing. It's just words about something. If it's not part of your life, if your heart is not opening, so this is the mystery that all of the poems move around. It is a difficult thing to talk about because it's got to be lived.
What's that experience? I know it's hard to talk about, but Zuleika, what's that like for you?
Well, I was just thinking about, there was a mentor who Coleman and I both knew named Joe Miller, who used to say, it can't be taught, it has to be caught. And he used to tell us that all the time. And I think that, I think sometimes people have an opening and then something disappointing happens and we shut down. And I think these poems are a helpful reminder that even in the shutdownness is an inquiry, where you might feel completely left out or something like that. You know, everyone goes through these things. And then somehow you remember by reading one of these images that too is a doorway home. And I think that's very helpful, actually.
So in the concert that we're going to see tomorrow night at the Lensic, Zuleika, how much of it, if any, is improvised, or is it all rehearsed and set? How much of it is like last year versus something new this year?
Well, I think most of the poetry is new because of this beautiful new book. And I would say our process is a certain way, where there's a way we get together and we go over things. Everyone reads the poetry and has their own response with it. And then what happens is new on the stage. So it's nothing we've done before, but it might remind you of something. Oh, yeah, that's kind of like what I saw, but, oh, it's a little different. And, well, it was sort of the same, but I can't explain it, you know. There's a feeling of familiarity and heartness, I think, that happens. And then there's new, because we haven't done this particular version of it yet. So that's exciting, and I have a new story, so I'm excited.
Don't tell us the new story, but where is it from?
It's an old Sufi story.
Oh, okay.
It's an old mystical story that's very current, in a sense. The wisdom in it is very helpful, and I wish I could tell it to you, but I won't.
When you are working with this kind of poetry, which in itself, doing it the way you both are doing it, it sort of becomes its own kind of spiritual practice, and the wisdom is there to be had and to be worked for on every page. And the way you just said it, Zuleika, that you said something, I think you said it's useful. Here we are in maybe one of the craziest times in the history of the human race, where we're witnessing the impending death of the oceans and the forests and the horrors that human beings are inflicting on not only each other, but on every species on the planet. It's almost unfathomable. Is there anything in Rumi, and there's a question for you too, Coleman, that helps you to understand or think about or deal with this moment in our history?
Well, go ahead, Zuleika.
Okay, I would just say that my response to it, of course, is first is great, great sorrow. I have great sorrow about all this. And then what happens after that is I feel I have to do something useful. And so that allows me to practice dancing, which allows me to remember that there is joy in the midst of sorrow. There is love in the midst of despair. And when maybe St. Francis said it very well. I can't quote the whole prayer that he said, but in the middle of, I think Rumi says it, dance in the middle of your fighting, dance when you've torn the bandage off, dance in the middle of the whole thing, dance. And that's such a challenge. I feel like he gave us that challenge, in a sense. What do you have to say?
Well, the passage comes to mind that he says, unfold your own myth without complicated explanations. So everyone will understand the passage, we have opened you. Start walking toward Shams, the teacher, the sun. Your legs will get heavy and tired. Then comes a moment of feeling the wings you have grown, lifting. So maybe that experience, feeling yourself moving into another dimension, is what maybe what he would say about what it feels like to unfold your own story in the midst of this tragic time we're living in, and yet there's great joy in it too.
We've got exciting time. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've just got a moment left. I wanted to give Zuleika the opportunity to talk about the fact that this concert is a benefit for the Story Dancer Project's wellness literacy programs for Santa Fe Public Elementary School children.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that we have a program in the schools that works with our core wellness exercises, and it's a creative supplement to literacy we work with in Spanish and English, and facilitators go actually into the classrooms of over 1,000 children and read stories because children aren't read to anymore. And then in the middle of the stories, when everybody's getting all wiggly, we get everyone up and move around because there's no more recess in the schools either.
Oh, Lord.
And so this concert and the concept of it and the feeling of the joy is also what we are working to bring into the classrooms again in our program. So that's what this concert is benefiting.
The event is the Rumi Concert, an evening of poetry, music, dance, and story with poet and translator of Rumi, Coleman Barks. And by the way, his new book is called The Big Red Book, the great masterpiece celebrating mystical love and friendship. Zuleika, story dancer, will be there, and cellist David Darling and percussionist Glenn Velez. It's all tomorrow night, the 1st of December at 7:30 at the Lensic. For tickets, 988-1234. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so
much.
Thank
you.
And we'll go out now with just a little bit of music by David Darling. I'd like now to welcome to the program Gary Steingart. His new novel is called Super Sad True Love Story, and he will be reading tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be here.
This is an amazing novel, and I was thinking maybe we could start with your reading the first page or so. Start
sure.
at the beginning.
Yeah. The novel is sort of a diary. Written by one Lenny Abramov, almost 40-year-old man, and his lover is 24-year-old Eunice Park, Korean-American woman. And in this, this is sort of just the beginning, when Lenny talks about his fear of death. June 1, Rome. Dearest diary, today I've made a major decision. I am never going to die. Others will die around me. They will be nullified. Nothing of their personalities will remain. The light switch will be turned off. Their lives, their entirety, will be marked by glossy marble headstones bearing false summations. Her star shone brightly, never to be forgotten. He liked jazz. And then these two will be lost in a coastal flood or get hacked to pieces by some genetically modified future turkey. Don't let them tell you life's a journey. A journey is when you end up somewhere. When I take the number 6 train to see the social worker, that's a journey. When I beg the pilot of this rickety United Continental Delta American plane, currently trembling its way across the Atlantic, to turn around and head straight back to Rome and into Eunice Park's fickle arms, that's a journey. But wait, there's more, isn't there? There's our legacy. We don't die because our progeny lives on. The ritual passing of the DNA, Mama's corkscrew curls, his granddaddy's lower lip. I believe the children are our future. I'm quoting here from The Greatest Love of All, by 1980s pop diva Whitney Houston, track 9 of her eponymous first LP. Utter nonsense. The children are our future only in the most narrow transitive sense. They are our future until they too perish. The song's next line, teach them well and let them lead the way, encourages an adult's relinquishing of selfhood in favor of future generations. The phrase, I live for my kids, for example, is tantamount to admitting that one will be dead shortly, and that one's life, for all practical purposes, is already over. I'm gradually dying for my kids would be more accurate.
Gary Steingart from Super Sad True Love Story. So this very vulnerable, appealing, highly articulate protagonist likes to read books. Now, this is set in the, what would you call it, near future?
In the near future, but so near that it could be next Tuesday for all I know.
Right. And but everybody is on their cell phones, which are called apparats, and this guy actually reads books, which is considered very old-fashioned.
Very old-fashioned, and kind of people are upset by this. You know, amongst the younger generations in this future, books are considered to have a bad smell. And they smell like wet socks to younger people who have never really picked up a book. Colleges don't really teach books. They teach text reading, which is sort of looking very quickly at a text and figuring out what advice you can take from it, like shopping advice. Eunice, who is Lenny's lover, is a major, goes to a women's college called Elderbird College, and her major is images, and her minor is assertiveness, how to be assertive in a shopping context, let's say.
And at a certain point, there's this sort of poignant moment where she says, I've never learned to read a text. I've only learned to glean information from it, or
to
something
scan
like
scan
that.
It.
To scan it, yeah.
Right. Well, I think that's sort of the idea you have. You know, reading is not an activity that many younger people want to partake of. So it's really something that's foisted upon them in class. There's very little leisure reading after you graduate from college or wherever it is. But when you're in a school, the point of a text is not to enjoy it, but to get as much info out of it as you can and then be able to write about it.
The world that you show us, and it's such an interesting world because it's so much like the world we live in, but just sort of more so. I mean, there's a total lack of privacy. You go into a bar with your little apparat and you can see people's age, credit ratings, cholesterol numbers instantly. People are constantly rating each other. And it's a kind of satire, but it's like a kind of satire that is so realistic that it's just like real life under a magnifying glass.
Yeah, well, I'm not much of a science fiction writer since I barely graduated from a math and science high school. It's not something I'm good at. I'm no Margaret Atwood. So what I focus on is really the social aspects. This is a kind of social satire. It's set in the future primarily because there's no real present left anymore. You know, you write about something and in a month it's gone. Imagine if I was writing a few months ago and a few years ago and I'd be writing about MySpace, which is now pretty much defunct.
Right.
And today I'd be writing about Facebook, which probably will be defunct in a few years as well. So we don't live in, you know, when Tolstoy was writing War and Peace, he was writing in the 1860s, but about 1812, you know, a horse was a horse, a carriage was a carriage. Some things had changed. The Industrial Revolution had started. But for the most part, you know, it was life was much more static. Another real book that really influenced this was, I think, 1984.
Yeah.
The idea of privacy is very interesting. In 1984, it's a hostile government that takes away people's privacy. Big Brother, you're constantly being monitored. In this book, as in our, I think, reality, people voluntarily give up their privacy. They voluntarily give up their information to try to get a little bit of one-upsmanship in terms of climbing up the social ladder. So privacy is seen as something that's actually as ugly as books and something you want to get rid of.
I have been wondering about Facebook, which I use and which I rather enjoy. I mean, if any spy agency wanted to invent a system where people voluntarily give up all their data, their political affiliations, their location, their friendships, there you have it.
Well, there you have it. And, you know, we've seen it at use Twitter and Facebook. We've seen it already happen, when certain so-called social media revolutions that happen in countries like Moldova or Iran, you know, where people think that the young people can overturn a society's repressive rulers by use of these media. But in the end, what sort of happens is the secret agencies of these countries or the police, they just basically are able to monitor what these kids are doing, so with horrifying effects. So, I really don't think that this is going to be some kind of cure-all. People look for technology to be a real the magic bullet that's going to change our society, but in the end, technology is just something that we're layering upon ourselves, you know, and in some ways it does more harm to us than the good that we extract from it. Having said that, I do have a Facebook page, which I started for this, my publicist started for this book, but it's mostly, you know, pictures of dachshunds. it's mostly what it is.
Proving your extraordinary good taste.
My extraordinary good taste, exactly. So, in the future, if a spy agency would instead of waterboarding me, I don't know, they would, strap me to an explosive dachshund or something.
Lenny Abramov. We're talking to Gary Steingart about his new novel. So this Lenny works for a company that sells not just anti-aging technology, but actual immortality technology, which you sort of refer to in the very beginning of the book, in the passage that you read, medical immortality sold to high net worth individuals. And we see, you paint a picture of a kind of reductionism where emotions are reduced to chemical phenomena and even love is seen for its health benefits. And it brings up in the reader all kinds of questions about what, if anything, is an end in itself.
Well, yes, and there's no worse end in itself than death, obviously, which is the ultimate end. I came to this country when I was a child. I was born in the Soviet Union, and I came when I was about 7 years old. And what's always fascinated me is, you know, Americans will not take no for an answer. You know, if there's a problem, there's a way to solve it using Americans' great financial means. But death is a little trickier, isn't it? It's very hard to trick that one. So Lenny works for a company called Post Human Services, which is trying to find a cure for death. And the clients are high net worth individuals. In this society, the dollar is almost worthless, so it's the Chinese yuan that's the major currency. And people hoard, you have to have billions of yuan to try to enter this program. What's interesting is, again, this is not something that's purely inventive on my part. There's a gentleman named Ray Kurzweil who writes a book about, I think it's called the Transhuman Movement, if I'm not mistaken. The singularity is one of these concepts where if we maintain a certain, if we follow certain medical advice and procedures, we'll be able to live for a very long time. And ultimately the goal is to download ourselves into this giant sort of cloud computer where we will live on forever in that format. So, you know, another way of saying, you know, we can solve any problem, including death. And that's just not going to happen, I think. But it's very sweet to think about it. And I like the impulse behind it, the idea that, you know, it never ends.
Well, I mean, there's the impulse behind it, but then there's also the mentality that it creates along the way, which is you've got all the time in the world to fill with what? You know, snap off underwear and all these products and all this crazy stuff that is just shallow and meaningless and on some deep level a waste of time.
Right. Well, it's interesting. The way I thought about it is this, that in this future, everyone is obsessed with social media. Everyone carries around these devices that are called the apparatus, as you mentioned. You know, I go into a bar, I'm automatically ranked the seventh ugliest man in the bar, but I have the third best credit rating. You know, everyone ranks everyone else, which is already sort of happening. I mean, I can go on Amazon and see how my book is being ranked. I can go on Rate My Professor and see how I'm ranked there, et cetera, et cetera. So these rankings already I can go to a bank and try to apply for a mortgage and see what my credit ranking is. So ranking is the dominant form of social interaction. But the high net worth individuals, the really rich people in this book, they don't even wear the apparatus. They don't need it. You know, they know who they are, and they don't have to constantly update their information. So it's the very powerful that don't need this constant entree into this technical world.
Lenny falls in love with this young Korean-American woman named Eunice Park, whom he meets in Italy, and she is a combination of all kinds of things. She's totally contemptuous of Lenny when she meets him. She's superficial in a lot of ways. She's also very compassionate. She works with trafficked Albanian women, refugees. She works later on with other people who are vulnerable victims of society, but she doesn't want to be political either, and she's part of this whole apparat culture, and she thinks that Lenny is ancient, and she's very contemptuous of things like gray hair and imperfect feet and things like that. And I'm watching her, and she's from this Korean family, and she's identified with being Korean in many ways. Is she a composite? Are there people like her?
I would assume almost any character, you're right, that there are some real life, you know, there's some analogies to almost any character you create. What interests me about Eunice is that she is, you know, I mean, some readers may think, oh, she shops online all day long, she's kind of a ditz. But in this society, among her peer group, she's actually one of the smartest people around. She uses actual sentences. Most people don't, talking is called verballing in this society, and the young hate to do it. They'd rather just, you know, write. They use almost entirely abbreviations, like Timatov, which means think I'm about to openly vomit, which is something Eunice says when she sees Lenny in his feet.
Which sounds vaguely Russian.
Which sounds like Timatov or Hebrew or something, yeah. So, you know, but she is very smart because she does use a subject and a predicate in sentences. And Lenny calls her my reluctant sentence monger. She's so advanced in the use of sentences. But around her, almost nobody speaks in complete sentences. So she's something of the future. But at the same time, there's something traditional about her. And I think Lenny admires that because he is possibly the most traditional man on the planet at this point, having, you know, reading books and also having books in his house. And when Eunice first moves in with Lenny, because he knows that the youth think that books smell like wet socks, he sprays all his bookshelves with Pine-Sol, Wildflower Blast.
Now, Lenny, one can't help but notice, is not entirely unlike you in many ways. The way you describe him, he looks like you. He's the child of Russian immigrants or Soviet immigrants. Well, is it Soviet by that point? Probably not Russian. And lives in New York as you do and so on. How do you use your own life, but also, I mean, it's a work of fiction. It obviously is you in some ways and not in others.
Mm-hmm. Well, the differences are huge. I mean, Lenny's 39, I'm 38. His bald spot is shaped like Ohio. Mine is more like West Virginia, I would say. So very big differences. Actually, what's funny is that the apartment he lives in, 575 Grand Street, is exactly where I lived. And then I recently sold the apartment as the book was going into publication. So it was very funny.
No, it was the same thing. I mean, I looked you up, and it was like, oh, his 740 square foot apartment. That
was for sale, yeah.
Yeah, that's so, you know, Gary's, not just Lenny's.
Right. So so here's the thing is, you know, you look at the things in your life that make sense, and then you take them. And then you take things that are not there, and you just exaggerate them. You know, this is, I think, how satire works. I'm afraid of mortality, but not quite to the effect to the point where Lenny is. You know, I'm not consumed by it. I live in a corporate consumerist culture, downtown New York. You know, to what effect does that affect? How does that affect me? Not as much as Lenny's. I don't quite spend so much time brooding on it. But you know, there's certain qualities that I like about Lenny that hopefully I share with him. His love of books, for example, that belief that even though literature right now is being so eclipsed in our culture, has become a very small part of the cultural sphere. You know, I think, and my theory is, and it's kind of silly, but I think that during times of great upheaval, it's the visual arts that begin to dominate, and literature that begins a kind of deep retreat. You know, the collapse of the Roman Empire would be one nice example of that. But the books have been, I can't imagine a life without them, and I think, you know, I just did a tour of America, and I went to maybe 50 different places, and everywhere I go, there's still small communities, like little monks keeping up knowledge in the time of the Dark Ages that are still wonderful reading communities.
We're talking to Gary Steingart. There's this moment in the book where Lenny has to move out of his apartment very quickly. He has to deal with his great wall of books, and he says, I felt the weakness of these books, their immateriality, how they failed to change the world, and I didn't want to sully myself with their weakness anymore. I wanted to invest my energies in something more fruitful and conducive to a life that matters. And when you contemplate the current political situation, it's in upheaval, as you say. It's run almost entirely by corporate money. You're writing a book. Mm-hmm. You're not doing visual art.
No.
What are your thoughts about the effect or usefulness?
It's really funny. I mean, people always say to me, do you want your book to change the world, to change the world you're living in? And my take on it is, I don't know what can really change this world anymore. You know, we've obviously many of us have expected so much, such a change 2 years ago when the political system seemed to be going in a good direction. And we've been many of us have been quite disappointed by the outcomes so far. It's very hard to change the world, especially when, you know, certain things happen. Great empires rise and then they fall. There's nothing new to that. I grew up in one failed empire, the Soviet Union, and now I'm living in America, so, you know, draw your own conclusions. To me, it's interesting that, there's very little that I can do through this book other than report on things the way I see them. So I see this almost as a kind of journalistic act. You know, I'm sitting here, this is what I'm seeing. The decline of literature, the decline of discourse, of intelligent discourse, the interest in immortality, and this sort of Argentinianization of America as America becomes a country with a very small upper class and a huge impoverished class. You know, these are the things that interest me, and I'm basically writing them down. I'm setting them hopefully in a humorous kind of setting, you know, in a slightly futuristic setting. But what really drives it are the same things. You know, families worry about the future. America for the first time in a while is going to have the next generation will be poorer than the generation that preceded it. And people fall in love, and love sucks. And that's, that's if you want a synopsis, that would be it.
It's so beautifully observed and so real and so funny. And, one can't help but think of Orwell. But also I was thinking about Nabokov when I was reading this. Is he a great influence
great
of yours?
Great influence, of course. Nabokov is amazing. I mean, I was born maybe 200 meters from where he was lived as a child.
Is that right?
Yeah, in St. Petersburg. And whenever I go back to Russia almost every year, and I always visit his museum. It's a tiny museum, but look, he was an amazing person. He styled prose the way nobody had before him, and I would say since him. He had a kind of almost, his kind of perception of words as that went beyond the way we see words, but really united with sound and color and everything imaginable. He was also both lucky and unlucky in the same way that I was, in the sense that he grew up in tumultuous times and was moved across the world. Russia fell apart and became the Soviet Union when he was a teenager. And then he ended up in Berlin and then Paris and New York, constantly being shifted from one place to another. And to a lesser extent, I can commiserate with that, having been born in one country and become an immigrant as a child. It changes the way you look at the world, and it changes the way you think of language. When I write, I have a secondary soundtrack of Russian going on in the back of my mind.
Do you?
Yes, and that's very helpful, especially when so many of my characters are Russian-American or Russian. So it's very helpful to have that kind of secondary... I guess here in New Mexico, this is also a kind of bilingual place, so I'm sure that's very helpful to people. It's like having a savings account in a different language. It's quite nice.
Yeah, it's another way of seeing. But I was thinking about this with you. I mean, you came over here when you were a kid, 7 years old, young enough to learn English perfectly without an accent and so on. But I guess...
It took a long time, actually, for me to lose my accent. I was about 14 years old. And the reason for that was that my parents only spoke Russian in the house. So whenever and even in school, I went to this Hebrew school, it was very conservative, and I didn't have any friends, so I would just sit there in the cafeteria and talk to myself in Russian, and it wasn't until 14 that I began to lose my accent. Interestingly enough, I know a couple of writers who are immigrant writers who have sort of similar circumstances, and they have accents to this day. I worked very hard. I stood there in front of the mirror and try to scrub my accent of any, because that was, it was a horrible time to be a Russian. It was in the early 80s, Ronald Reagan, the evil empire, all those movies, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, whatever, so it was, being a Russian kid was very bad.
I was struck, Lenny has a couple of friends in the novel, but he seems to be so isolated. What about all the people who were also literary types who were older than he and so on, who were keeping mm-hmm. that world alive?
Well, I think that they don't really communicate to one another, because the real communications in this book are all done over the over these devices. And, it's very rare for people to meet up for any purpose other than to rank one another. So it's a world of more where quiet contemplation is really reserved for just a few. I mean, the book sort of doesn't say it, but it is possible that Lenny is the last reader of books.
Gary Steingart is author of the book Super Sad True Love Story. He will be reading tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and signing books and doing Q&A.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll sign anything.
Well, it's great to have you on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.